Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, need a little help. Say it for us.
Need a little help, y'all. Need a little happy hand. Wake up, everybody. Welcome to MPH History. And we're going to tell you, wake up to MPH Radio. Welcome to Missing Pages, a history radio show. As always, we are here to serve the underserved communities and to remind them that they belong. They belong in the history books. We, too, are a part of the community, and we're going to make sure that we serve as a tool known to help liberate our communities and humanity, but also to ensure that the whole world knows that we, too, belong to this world history. This is MPH Radio. We welcome you today on the 24th day of April 2021. Our theme today is What's Going On in the Nick of Your Woods. That's right, later on we'd like for you to dial in and share with us what's going on in the Nick of Your Woods. Until then, what we're going to do for today is to get started by talking about give me something to think about. What is freedom? That'll be followed by some historical facts, which we call MPH Black Men Facts, by Susie. And that will be followed by Mr. Ellis Journal, will give a statement to the community, or as we say, a message to the community. And then we will open up for discussions on a day's theme, what's going on in the nick of your woods. That will be the order of the program today. We encourage you to listen in as well as to call in at 818-337-0016. Hit 1, and we will allow you to share your views, your perspectives to the various information that will be presented today on MPH Radio. So let's get started on today's program by giving you something to think about, as we often think about, fight about, and doubt about this whole concept of freedom. We highlighted three individuals who gave their definition of what freedom means to them. From an unknown stated, when you come to the point where you have no need to impress anybody, your freedom will begin. Think about that concept. When you come to the point where you have no, when you have no need to impress anybody, your freedom will begin. A second concept of freedom from Charles Kingsley. He stated, there are two freedoms, the false, where a man is free to do what he lacks, the true, where he is free to do what he ought. Let me read that one again back to you. There are two freedoms, the false, where a man is free to do what he lacks, the true, where he is free to do what he ought. That's by Charles Kingsley. And last for today is a third conception of freedom by Naval Ruffinkent. He stated, I value freedom above anything else. Freedom to do what I want. Freedom from not doing what I don't want to do. And freedom from my own reactions and emotions, things that may disturb my peace. Let me read that one again. I value freedom above anything else. Freedom to do what I want. Freedom from not doing what I don't want to do. And freedom from my own reactions and emotions, things that may disturb my peace. So those are your three concepts of freedom today. Once you think about it, later on you can chime in on what you think about these concepts. Until then, we're going to take a quick station break, and when we come back, get your pen and pencils out. Susie, who is a member contributor of Missing Pages of History, going to give you some MPH Black Men Facts. So get your pen and paper ready, and we'll be right back. This is Missing Pages History Radio, MPH Radio.
Tennessee. Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters be messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know. Out of my skull, my grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force and truth. Some strange reason
country and into more country. Baptized birth into Richmond, where the ghosts of childhood hungry. Walk the road my forefathers walked, climb the trees my forefathers hung from. Ask those trees for all their wisdom. They tell me my ears are so young. Go back to whence you came, my family tree, my family name. For some strange reason it had to be, he guided me to Tennessee.
Down to Holly Springs. Razadon and Baba, they went down to Peachtree. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes!
Now I see the importance of history. While my people be in the mess that they be. Many journeys to freedom made in vain. By brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me? Without the enlightenment of all my folks. Reject, cause I set myself on a quest for truth. And you was there to quench my thirst. But I am still thirsty. Lord, allow me to drink some more. He said what I am searching for are the answers to all which are in front of me. The ultimate truth started to get blurry. For some strange reason it had to be. It was all a dream about Tennessee.
Take me to another land. Take me back home. Take me to the family. It's the family tree. Welcome to MPH Radio. We are back from our station break with music with a message. And then we hope that you have had time to get out the pen and pencil and have the youth with the earphones to their ears and to learn a little something about their history and their contribution to humanity. And right now, we're going to turn the mic over to Susie, who is a member contributor of Missing Page of History at MPH Radio, and she's going to share with you some history of our people's struggles, past, present, and we want you to make sure you write it down and learn it if you don't know it. Because as Brother Malcolm stated, history is best to reward those who research. So, Susie, what you have for this week dealing with our MPH Black Men and Facts? We'll turn the mic over now to you. Welcome, Susie, to MPH Radio.
Good evening. I'll begin you the Black History Facts from April the 18th through the 24th. And this is coming out of the PARSP calendar of 2021. The first one is April the 18th, where the colonized African and Asian people hold the historic Banjul Congress in Indonesia, try to organize nations of Africa and Asia. And this happened in 1955. And also during this time period, Zimbabwe gained political independence from British settler colonialism in 1980. On the 19th, Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO, of Namibia, founded in 1960. On April the 27th, jazz genius Charles Mingus was born in 1922. And the last one for the week of April the 18th through the 24th is the 23rd, the Granville Woods African inventor of more than 20 patent devices, was born in 1856. And finally, the student walkout and strike in Farmville, Virginia, opens new arena, a struggle and battle against U.S. apartheid in 1951. There you have the history for April the 18th through the 24th. Many Black Facts.
Thank you, Susie, for the MPH Many Black Many Facts. We hope that people have taken notice and note and learned something new today. And if they didn't, they will have been reminded of some of the history that's often omitted from the history books. We just want to correct that error, and this is why we came to existence. One of the reasons. Right now, again, we're going to a quick break again, and when we come back, we have a special message from the community, from Alice Joyner. You're listening to Missing Pages of History, MPH Radio. We'll be right back. Right, welcome back to MPH Radio, learning to love yourself, learning to love your people, learning to love humanity is the greatest love of all. We're walking back from a music with a message, and we'll continue to move forward by now bringing in Alex Joyner, who will share with you today a message to the community. Brother Alex, welcome to MPH Radio. The mic is yours.
Well, thank you again, Brother Lee. Thank you, Susie. Thank you for the other honored guest here today. And I appreciate all the listeners and the callers who may comment later. And I would like to say that over the past couple of weeks, we have been astounded with a sight that has terrified many, has given people nightmares, have given people the cause to question their God. Even the President of the United States realized something's wrong with America. So I give you today 9 minutes, 29 seconds. Who was really on trial? April 20th, 2021 was a day already special to me. It was my birthday. I had planned to celebrate it to the fullest. Last year, the nation was in total lockdown from COVID-19, and I could not go anywhere to enjoy it. As I lay down on the night of April 19, 2021, storm clouds were brewing. I thought I heard thunderclap way into the night. I awoke the next morning, and there was calm outside. There was a coolness in the air that gave me a chill I can't explain. Later in the day, as I left one of my favorite restaurants, I turned on the news like anyone else who had been following the murder trial of George Floyd for the past 3 weeks. And there was breaking news on the jury's decision. I did not expect to see a return verdict in a few days. I believe that due to the testimony and the evidence, it may take weeks. I had served on the jury, and I know the process. I believe, like so many others, that because a peace officer was being charged with murder, they have to find a way to say he was not at fault. George Floyd's life history had been told before. The prosecution had presented an excellent case. They told the world of a good guy, as George told the officers himself before they murdered him. He was not a man constantly assaulting people, selling drugs, or a basic street thug. He was a man who played football and basketball in college, a family man who loved his daughter and his fiancée. He loved his siblings and did the best for them. He worked as a truck driver and a bouncer at the same nightclub Chauvin had worked at. He was a man who spent time with his six-year-old daughter, Gianna. We heard her say, "Daddy changed the world." We learned of a man who was a mama's boy, a humble man who cried out for his mama with his dying breath. He knew and feared the laws of the street, that any bad police officer could take your life any day they choose, and the law would be on their side. We saw George plead to the officers not to shoot him when they approached him with guns drawn, ready to fire. We learned of a big man who was compliant and did what he was told by the police. But one officer, Derek Chauvin, on that day of May 25th, 2020, was not satisfied with this being a simple arrest and a trip to small claims court. Being compliant was not enough. He wanted Mr. Floyd to know who was his master. He saw a few people gathering around, and he decided to take matters into his own hands. Regardless of the law, humanity and the rights of one in his care and custody, the officer chose to subdue him into compliance until his last breath and beyond. He wanted to make sure Mr. Floyd wouldn't be a problem anymore, period. The defense tried to defend the defenseless actions of a bad cop. They dragged Mr. Floyd's name in the dirt like they did his lifeless body as it was deposited on the gurney without care or concern, as a 9-year-old girl watched and feared. His history of past drug use, they assumed, would be a staple in the case for the dismissal of all charges. Every excuse was made to say the officer did right. His fellow officer and commander said, no, this is not how we train or implement in our care and custody. Too much excessive force and no compassion for the badge the officer wore. They all turned their backs on him. The medical evidence of drug use was common, as with many households in America. But that did not kill George. A bad heart was ruled out with other health complaints. There is no one in perfect health, as we can all die at any moment. Fumes from a car that wasn't running was ridiculous. Finally, they ran out of excuses and realized that the crowd of people that pleaded with the officer to remove the knee from Mr. Floyd's neck and give him assistance was right. An off-duty EMT worker and a 61-year-old man tried all they could to provide citizens assistance. But they were denied and told they weren't needed. No help was on the way for George. Only hatred bared down on him. There was nothing anyone could do but witness injustice from the ones who were supposed to stand for justice. They were watching as he did for 3 weeks, bearing witness to a black man being murdered in broad daylight on one of America's streets. I did not expect to hear a verdict so soon, as the closing arguments brought me to tears for a man I didn't know. I drove to his funeral. I saw his golden coat. I wrote about George. I spoke about George. I marched for George. And now, this was it. I did what I could do. I was in fellowship with the Lord that the right thing would be done. The jury had come in, and I was prepared for the outcome. My heart beat faster. I began to sweat, and I felt like I couldn't breathe. Would they let another officer off for killing a black man in front of the whole world? Everyone was watching and waiting. The soul of the people of America waited. Then the judge read, guilty. 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 On all charges, the conscience and heart of America was on trial. And now, and every day going forward, we as a nation must move in a direction of peace, love, and understanding for each other and for all our brothers, nations, and races. We have been divided by laws and governments who do not have our best interests in heart, to profit from confusion and mistrust. As the people may argue and fight, they make a profit in our death. I remind the world to lift every voice and sing. Sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us, full of hope that the present has brought us, facing the rising sun of our new day begun. Let us march on until victory is won. We have come over a way that with tears have been watered. treading our path through the bloodshed of the slaughter. Out from the gloomy path till now we stand at last. May we forever stand true to our God, true to our native land, our native land. Lift every voice and sing his name forever into history. George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd. Thank you, George, for sacrificing your life. Rest in peace, brother. And I thank you.
We'd like to thank you, Mr. Joyner, for your commentary and message to the community. Right now, we're going to have a quick station break, a message, music with a message. And when we come back, we're going to begin our theme tonight. What's going on in the nick of your woods? On this theme, we will have a discussion with Ms. Shirley Pate, who will share some interesting news about what has taken place or is taking place in Washington, D.C., under the mayor's office, where we talk about allocating $350 million. And we'd like to talk about that, its impact on our communities, along with a discussion with a recent police trainer, David Grossman, an Army Ranger and former psychology professor at West Point, who created and popularized the science of chaosology. That's right, I said chaosology, where he states in lecture on how great sex is after you kill someone. Call it perks of the job. Now repeat that. We're going to have that discussion on professor who trained police officers who talks about how great sex is after you kill someone. As well as we hope to have an update on Mamiya and his medical condition situation. This and more as we begin to talk about what's going on in the nick of our woods when we return. That's right. Let's stick together. Let's stick together. That's what we're trying to do. We are sticking together on the MPH Radio. We'd like to welcome you back as we begin to address our theme today. What's going on in the nick of your woods? If you'd like to share your thoughts on what's going on in the nick of your woods, please feel free to do this by dialing 818-337-001681, and we will acknowledge your last four numbers. Right now, we bring in Miss Shirley Pate. She's a resident of Washington, D.C. We'd like to welcome her to MPH Radio. And Miss Pate, or can we call you Sister Shirley? What's going on in the nick of your woods?
Well, some very interesting things and that seemed to involve a fair amount of political maneuvering on the part of our mayor. On April the 16th, I and other residents of the District of Columbia received one of our usual weekly emails from the mayor, but this one had a very interesting title, and it was, "Need help with rent and utilities? We got your back." And as I looked at the title, I said to myself, this is like something I often see in my inbox, which is a deal that's being offered that really seems too good to be true. The mayor proceeded in her email to explain that D.C. had a fund of $350 million that they would use to do the following. One is it would help residents pay back rent all the way back to April 2020. It would also help pay forward up to 3 months rent. It would help with water, gas, and electricity payments, and it would have some sort of a program to do extended housing for up to 18 months in advance. And looking at this, if you go back to the title, and the title is Rent and Utilities, and it appears to me and appeared to those of us who discussed this very issue on Africa on the Move last Sunday night that this was a political calculation on the part of the mayor to get money back into the hands of the landlords in this city and the utility companies as well. Now, another thing that must be playing into this, because I don't think it can be ignored, is that D.C., its bill to become a state just passed the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday. And by the way, the name that is chosen if D.C. becomes a state would be Washington Douglas Commonwealth, named after Frederick Douglass. But as the mayor of the District of Columbia, she has been very aggressive in making sure this measure is gotten through the House. I think it's going to have a tough time in the Senate, but the most likely candidate, should D.C. become a state, at least one of them, would be Muriel Bowser, our mayor. So I think that with all the problems that D.C. has about making sure that the residents are being provided for during these COVID times, there are many other needs that they need help with, because I cannot see the landlords of this city nor the utility companies that operate in this city to allow $350 million go to the residents of this city. So this is the issue we're looking at, and I will let everybody else take it from here.
And on that note, what we're going to do, we're going to open up our phone lines based upon what we just heard about this package of $350 million going through the mayor's office of D.C. What do y'all make of this kind of, I've said, political maneuvering as a way to finance some money, and how this virus epidemic is playing a role in terms of our to continue to enrich the rich and take from the poor. So we can open up call 818-337-0016 at 1, and we acknowledge your comments. Right now, we will start off with you, Brother Alex. When you heard the information, you talk about a package deal going to the mayor of D.C. of $350 million in essence to fund money to the utilities of the landlords of Washington, D.C. What do you make of this, Brother Alex?
Well, I look at a situation that happened many years ago, the Civil War. Lincoln in D.C. and the government made an arrangement to pay reparation to the white slave owners for the slaves. When we look at how our money is being channeled, how our money is being spent, just like the speaker just said, there seems to be pressing needs for everyone. Not with saying that, you know, landlords and utility companies don't need to get paid. Yes, everyone needs to be paid because their services don't come for free. We can't live anywhere for free. We have to pay. But there are other ensuring needs that need to be done. And when we look at a Stronger Together Act, or they're calling it Stay D.C., that's how it's going to be funded, $350 million. Also, through the American Rescue Plan, which I'm still reading now, trying to find out which direction that this plan is going in and who it's supposed to actually help. Because even in the American Rescue Plan, there are many companies, many businesses that will profit, and the people themselves will get scraps. The same thing with the Stay DC. The people themselves have gotten scraps, $1,400, $600, scraps, compared to what others will make. And that's what we have to concentrate on. How much longer will we continue to accept scraps? It didn't take them very long to pass this bill through the House. It may make a little resistance in the Senate, but I'm thinking it's probably going to pass, maybe with not as much money or whatever. But I do believe it will probably pass because it's putting money in the hands of the rich. And I don't know if anyone wants to say, I don't need it if I'm rich, but they will go ahead and accept it. The idea may have been started out well, but just like other ideas get changed and get formulated to help who they want to help. So that's what we have to look at. I would rather see the ideas in Congress that put more food stamps on those ones that need it. Give them more Social Security payments for the elderly, for the ones that need it. Better prescription drug costs, lower them, get rid of them for poor families and older Americans. There are many ideas that can be done. $350 million worth of ideas that can be done another way for another set of people. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, let's take our caller, 6029. What you think about $350 million package to D.C. Mayor? Call us 6029.
Yeah.
think we lost our caller. Let's see if we can find them back. We lost our caller. While we wait for our caller to maybe call back in, we lost them. Let's go to Susie. We're going to get your thoughts on it. Your thoughts on this package deal, Susie.
Okay. What I think is what it's doing is it's giving individuals a false comfort. You're going to cover them possibly up even to 18 months. But with unemployment, a lot of us still aren't getting employed. Then on top of it, what happens then? They tell you that either you be able to come up with it or you're back in the same situation again. It's going to make individuals even more frustrated than what they are because they are really not telling them the truth. What happens after that 18 months per those each attendance? They're going to be out in the street. Are they do they have some kind of incentive even after this $350 million that is going to still protect these people from losing their homes or their apartments? I think it's really just giving them a false hope or comfort for a couple months.
Thank you, Susie. Let's go back to call 6029. 6029, we're back with you. What you make of this $350 million package to DC Mail?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, well, I personally think that it's sort of suspect because when you stop and think about it, if you go to allocate $350 million, you know, to, quote, unquote, to the tenants in Washington, D.C., it seems to me there should be some criteria in terms of allocating that money. The mere fact I have not been able to access what are the criteria suggests there's some maneuvering going on behind the scenes that doesn't set well with me. But one thing is very, very clear. When you talk about it in terms of, you know, $350 million, you got to keep in mind that you got a city that needs to operate in budget. In order to do the things that needs to get done, then it has to have access to that money. So for the mayor to give up that kind of money, you know, specifically for, quote, unquote, to help tenants, you know, who are in arrears, speaks volumes in terms of potential for corruption that may be existing in Washington, D.C. at this time. And, of course, as the caller, your guest, alluded to, one of the things you got to be very concerned about is a kind of pre-quo that may be going on where the mayor is actually paid in terms of it's going to be paid for, you know, allocating this money to landlords. But clearly, when you stop and think about it, as your previous call alluded to, the problem is very, very clear, is that giving the people that money is only a stopgap measure, assuming they're going to get it. The problem is that, you know, after you pay the arrears for 2 or 3 months, the bottom line is that given the kind of economy or the kind of joblessness that exists in the society, the question becomes, what are people supposed to do after that two, three-month period is over, after those arrears are used up? So clearly, I think this is done to formulate, particularly to benefit of the landlords in Washington, D.C., as opposed to really being a real help to the citizenry here in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Carla. Stay on. We have some other issues we'd like to hear people's views on. I'll go back to Sister Shirley.
Could I add two things to what Brother Heskey just now mentioned, some very good points he made. You know, the mayor was pretty aggressive at making sure that she prevented the expiration of moratoriums on landlords being able to continue to collect rent. I think she cut a deal then with landlords that said, hang on, wait a couple of months, and we'll have money that we can make sure will get more directly back to your pocket to help you. And I also wanted to mention, I went into some of the requirements, the information they provided as part of this Stay DC program, and I tell you, it gave me a headache reading it. The way it is written so that it is very difficult to figure out who's eligible, who isn't, and to do mathematic calculations depending on the number of people in your household. So the more I look into this, the more the goal, the supposed goal of this will be attained by the mayor, because I think people are going to have a hard time figuring out how to even apply to get any of these funds. Thank you.
I hear you. Let's go to another resident of D.C., see if this resident has something to say about this matter. We'll go to caller 4298. Caller 4298. Your thoughts on this package deal, the $350 million package deal to the mayor of Washington, D.C.
Yes, very interesting dilemma there. The mayor put in sort of a catch-22. On the one hand, you want to do something to help the put money into the pockets of the renters and the citizenry to in order for them to stay stable and maintain residence within D.C. But how do you do that? Becomes the issue. What is the application process? Who's favored and who's not favored? Because we live in a class society and there's contradictions coming up. And so, but yeah, the landlord is the only one that we can see who's going to definitely unequivocally benefit from this package in the long run. I mean, it's a temporary thing for that goes in and out of the hands of tenants. If they are able to actually go directly to the tenants, probably going directly to the landlords anyway. But so it definitely benefits the landlord, and it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. What I will do right now is suggest to mention some information for folks who listen to this program. If they're interested in contacting me or direct or whatever, or individuals related to this program, I have access to a letter, April 16, 2021, stated letter to the mayor. It said, "Dear Washingtonians, this week we launched a new $350 million program to help D.C. residents pay their rent and utility bills. This program, STAY, S-T-A-Y, STAY D.C., provides financial assistance to residents unable to pay rent and or utilities due to COVID-19 pandemic." Now, one of the people you can email contact, they have mario.browser@dc.gov. The phone number is 202-727-2643. For more information, contact email that particular individual to find out maybe how you can benefit from it. But clearly, it seemed like there was a reparation package created for the landlords. That's what it sounds like to me. So in our final thoughts on this particular issue in terms of what's going on in Nick of Your Woods, I would just like to add to this discussion is that I think you're probably going to see a program similar to all of the cities around the country where the wealthy landlords and utility companies are going to use this as a model to rape the people. You know, they holler about when the individuals, the little so-called little people, get $100-$200. That's too much money, welfare. But it creates these kind of scenarios where they get all the welfare they need. So on that note, we ask each person maybe if they have a final thoughts on this. And then we're going to move on to our next topic on what's going on in Nick of Your Woods. We'll go to you real quickly, Alex. Any final thoughts on this issue? Alex.
Yes, I do. Because, again, the landlords, you know, we need them. The utility companies, we need them. But we also need the people that live there and live in those houses. And we have to have some kind of heart for the ones who lose their jobs and don't have something to put on the table every night. So we need to look at that bill more closely and suggest other bills that could come forward to help people truly in need. Not saying that again, the landlord's not in need, utilities company's not in need, but really help the people who are in need. and have been getting a less than fair share of what they deserve from a government that they pay taxes to, and vote that these people take care of them and be responsible to them as voters, as citizens, and not shunned upon and looked down upon and just say the rich deserve everything, the poor deserve nothing. So that is the nature of this country. And as the gentleman say, that's how it is. But we can change that's how it is if we only stick together, because they love division. As long as we can't get together, then they have all the power. But when the people can get together, the people assume the power and they take over. And the ideas of the past and lost generation are faded into the dust, because the reality is that we can only survive together if we work together. We can't be at odds, because we won't last long. So I'm hoping that some other legislation will come forward and provide some other ideas and other things. And that's my final thought.
Yeah, let's see. Brother, go to Carlo. Your final thoughts. You go to Carlo 6029. Your final thoughts on this issue, Carlo 6029.
Yeah, well, I think that's a much broader question involved in the situation. And that is people's right to housing. One of the problems that we currently got in place, a situation in which the wealthy prosper at the expense of the poor or working class people in society. Clearly, this kind of equation is going to lead to more death and more mayhem. And my concern is that if we don't do something in terms of addressing that fundamental imbalance that exists in the society, then we certainly can anticipate at some point in the future that you're going to have a revolution raging in the society. So it seems to me that this mayor of Washington, D.C. should be intimately aware of the potential or the repercussions of these kind of policies as it relates to the impact it has on poor people. And clearly she's taking a short-term approach. Her position is that apparently is that you less money to be had or position to be had, you know, by playing ball. Unfortunately, this is the belief of many political leaders who play ball with the powerful, for you know, because there's something to be gained from that participation. But clearly, you know, it seems to me that, you know, if we don't fundamentally address the inequality in terms of capitalist society, then we're spinning our wheels in terms of any potential to redress the kind of shameless kinds of policies, shameless kinds of business practices that take place to the detriment of the masses of people in the society. So it seems to me that there has to be some kind of discourse around the question in terms of precisely what is capitalism? Why does capitalism work in such a way that tends to render those who are worst off in horrible straits? And until that question is answered, I got a sneaking suspicion that this kind of injustice, a systematic injustice, is going to continue to be inflicted upon the most vulnerable in society. And as such, you know, that kind of injustice inflicted upon poor people is not only unethical, but it seems to me, just in terms of the country's longevity, it seems to me it's considering a policy that they should revisit. So clearly, you know, there's something fundamentally skewed in terms of, you know, how capitalism plays itself out. And I think this is an example in terms of the kind of corruption, the kind of malfeasance that is so typical of a capitalist policy.
Okay, Susan, your final thoughts on this particular issue.
Basically, I don't have a final thought. I'd just like to thank Ms. Pate for bringing the information to MPH Radio and the community, because it's one thing, it'll give us an avenue to look at our states and to see really what's going on and be able to ask some key questions if we see anything even with a semblance to this particular policy. I just want to thank Ms. Pate.
And on that note, we can go to Ms. Pate for her final thoughts. And, of course, I'd like to reiterate that point, Susie, in terms of her participation or sharing what's going on in Nickerwood. This was a very informative and important issue that I think the whole country, people in various communities, need to be aware of. Sister Shirley, we'll let you make your final thoughts on this issue.
All right. Thank you, Brother Lee. I agree. I think that this particular approach that the mayor is taking here in D.C. is going to be seen in other cities throughout the country. Now, no doubt part of this $350 million has come from federal government funds, I'm betting. And I think what's going to happen is that mayors are going to try to capitalize politically and try to look as benevolent as they can in order to get reelected by offering people assistance with terrible financial problems that have plagued them. And I think it's going to gain initially support from people when they see it. But I believe how it is implemented already has a fail mechanism that is planted into it. And once again, I restate the fact that corporations, landlords, real estate developers, and all these utilities are not in a relationship with the mayor of D.C. to see $350 million go to a direct pay to the citizens to help them. So I think it's something to be extremely suspicious of, and I imagine that there are housing organizations throughout the country. It would be probably beneficial, and I'm going to start seeing if I can investigate into them to see what issues they may be having of a similar kind, if they're seeing anything similar from their municipalities such as this. Thank you, and thank you all for your comments.
And we thank you, Ms. Pate, for your contribution to today's program. What we're going to do right now, we tell everybody, don't go nowhere, hold on. We will continue this discussion, what's going on in the neck of your woods, as we come back with a special guest, Brother Haki. He brings to this community an article of real important in terms of maybe you can get a better understanding of what's going on with all of these cops shooting people of color. It's an article that he shared with us that he would talk about a little bit, and we'd like for you to weigh in. And it's titled, Cop Trainer Lectures on How Great Sex Is After You Kill Somebody. Call it Perks of the Job. What do we make of that? So we'll be back with his take, and we'd like to have yours when we come back after this break of music with a message. This is MPH Radio.
Teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration. rising fast, the Beatles' new records again.
And the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation.
And the band played on.
Eve of destruction, tax deduction,
fear factors, fear collectors,
hardcore, Indian population out of hand.
Suicide, too many bills, hippies moving to the hills. People all over the world are shouting in the war.
And the band played on.
That's right, this is a world of a ball of confusion. And when we learn that history and writing no missing pages of history, the world will no longer be confused. So come and join us, help build this institution, help support MPH Radio. And if you'd like to become a friend and supporter of MPH Radio, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. We can tell you how, and come and join us. We need your help. We need your support. So let's continue to discuss what's going on in the neck of your woods. We have with us, we're bringing Brother Hakeem. There's an interesting article we encourage people to look at. And something that I think has a direct relationship or maybe what's going on in our community as it relates to this whole concept of policing. There's an article titled, written on the 23rd day of April. It's titled Cop Trainer Lectures on How Great Sex Is After You Kill Somebody. Call it Perks of the Job. At the beginning of the article, it talks about a specialized trainer, David Grossman, an Army Ranger and former psychology professor at West Point, who created and popularized the science of killology. The study of killing, I guess, killology. He goes around the country training groups of police. He says that sex after killing is a real high. I know sex was a powerful thing. Is this a new high that we're going to do, we're going to use today, we re-engage in? We're bringing Brother Hakeem. We let him talk about and articulate the significance of this article, and we'd like for you to weigh in. What do you think about this trainer who trained police officers? And he says sex after killing someone is a good high. So, Brother Hakeem, I let you describe the background narratives of the article and your points of interest in terms of what's going on in your world as it relates to this article. We bring you in, and we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio. Brother Hakeem, the mic is yours.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, brother, you know, I got to tell you, you know, in reading this article, you know, I'm still having a very difficult time processing this. See, one of the problems is that this guy pretty much defines what it is to be a cop in a society. And so when we talk about the kind of sociopathic tendencies that exist among so many law enforcement officials in this country, then one certainly could see, you know, how this guy, you know, could come to prominence. Now, for an individual like this to train other individuals to tell them or to actually state out loud that killing people is the greatest thing in the world to achieve, to say that, you know, after killing someone, sex is great, it seems to me that, number one, as a human being, I mean, how do you, by any stretch of the imagination, justify killing another human being? Now, superimposed upon that, how as a human being can you justify killing someone and then having great sex on top of that? What does that say about you, the individual? What does it say about your wife? Or if you're a female cop, what does it say about your husband? Also, clearly, this is very, very, very problematic. But I think one of the problems that, brother, I think, you know, the universe, I mean, the state of Massachusetts, the high court of Massachusetts, made a ruling mistake that, you know, if you're too intelligent, they can legally discriminate against you from becoming a cop. So when I listen to somebody like this particular individual talk about, you go on and on about how it is, how sex is great after killing someone, then it seems to me on a very, 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 very deep level, it seems to be just this fundamental understanding in terms of what it is to be human is lacking, and more importantly, what it is to actually be able to think in terms of, you know, saying things which are not only controversial but somehow things that somehow which are extremely problematic across the board. So maybe perhaps if they hire a better breed of cops, cops who actually can think, actually reason, they would have those, maybe have those kind of thoughts, but come to the conclusion that perhaps those kind of thoughts are not justified. In fact, that somehow it's often fundamentally wrong with any kind of thought which says that the fundamental destruction of another human being is a good thing to achieve. So clearly, when I read this, you know, I'm like, you know, but then I think about in terms of these killings, you know, one after the other. Clearly, two things are happening. One, African people are not perceived as human, and there's no question about that, because the response to African people versus others, particularly whites, is totally different. You have situations where white people actually are armed, who actually shoot people, have to kill people, and the police have been able to bring them in without killing them. Then you have African people who are unarmed and who are doing their thing and freeing the cops, who find themselves dead. So clearly that's a fundamental difference in terms of your response to black folks versus white folks. Also, I think you can't discount this question in terms of the history, because when we talk about the history in terms of policing, then we have to fundamentally understand, when we talk about the slave patrols, we understand that is, in fact, the offshoot of what we know today as the police. A lot of people don't understand that. And so, therefore, this kind of callousness, this kind of indifference, this kind of hatred toward African people is engendered, in fact, in the way police do their job. And so one of the things that he talked about, the fact that he talked about the bad guys, he kept alluding to the bad guys, the bad guys, the bad guys. And then you start thinking, it seems to me he sees it's kind of euphemism of sorts. It seems to me that what he really wants to say is that what he's really talking about is people of color. Those are the bad guys. Because normally when you talk about the bad guys in the context of law enforcement, you talk about people of color. So those white folks who commit crimes, particularly crimes or white-collar crimes, are not perceived as quote-unquote criminals, but perceived as someone who lost their way. Whereas historically, African people, irrespective of the kind of crime they commit, they're criminal across the board, whether you're talking about low-collar crime, high-collar crime, or whatever. So clearly, so when he talks about the fact that, the bad guys, you get a sense that he's talking about this is a euphemism for African or people of color. So clearly, Brother Africa, I think this is a problem. And one last thing before I close, I think one of the things you have to keep in mind is that given the kind of abuse that these guys suffer as law enforcement, because one of the things that law enforcement prides itself on is that they want people who follow orders, people who don't question things. And the problem in terms of being one who's a follower, one who doesn't question things, one thing, you tend to take a lot in terms of performing your job simply because you're expected to take a lot. But the psychic damage to your psychic in terms of being able to contend with the constant degradation of being a police officer day in, day out, being ridiculed and put down by your superiors, is a very tough thing to do. Now, you add that to the fact that you have access to a weapon on your side, and then you have people who are quote-unquote perceived as the enemy, then there's no wonder that these people would simply use that weapon in terms of killing African people simply because, number one, the kind of humiliation, degradation they receive on a normal basis, they can relieve that stress somehow by simply pulling that trigger and killing African people. So clearly this guy is problematic, but the mere fact that he wasn't fired or that people even invited him to the academies to speak to potential police officers speaks volumes in terms of the kind of legitimacy this kind of view has in law enforcement. I think as African people or people of color, I think we should be very concerned about this kind of mindset and all that it entails.
Yeah, Brother Haki, I thought it was an interesting article. When you read it, how he described himself and how the policeman put in their mind settings or see themselves as a sheepdog, one who protecting white sheep. And see the black sheep as bad guys, and have a compensation to kill. And that's a good thing because you're protecting white sheep. But you know, just this whole thing and how he associates that with the pleasure of sex. I just find that real, real amazing, interesting. And maybe if that's what's going on, if maybe not so much an issue of just training, but also issue just psychologically, the things they are doing psychologically to these officers to create this mindset. You know, your response, Brother Hackey.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. You know, one of the things when you stop and think about the kind of legitimacy bestowed upon somebody like this guy, essentially what you're saying is that what he's saying, the position that he holds, is legit. And I would argue that scientifically, particularly when we talk about psychology or sociology, the kind of things that he espouses are fact, you know, not legit. So the mere fact that law enforcement sees him legit, I think, is problematic. I think the kind of routine denigration or the routine kind of degradation that cops deal with on a daily basis, of course, is at some point it's going to have some kind of deleterious impact on the way the cops do their job. And, of course, given just speaking as a human being, one of the things, if you got a great deal of stress, a great deal of anger, if you're not particularly feeling good about yourself, if you can displace that anger, if you can place that anger or project that anger onto other people, then there's a human tendency to do that. So one of the problems in terms of having someone like this speak to the masses, to potential law enforcement, is that, you know, he sort of engenders all the bad things in terms of cops, and contrary to what you really need, which is cops who actually stop and think about situations and understand, you know, their feelings in terms of, you know, the kind of things they go through and being able to temper those feelings. With actually being effective in terms of doing their job. Now, being effective, of course, means that, you know, when you encounter a difficult situation, you don't use the justification in terms of blowing people away. If it can be resolved without the use of weaponry, then that's what you do. But increasingly what we're seeing is that the first response automatically is to whip out the weapon and fire. And recently the case in Columbus, Ohio, where the young girl was shot, it was very interesting because one of the things, if you're talking about, you know, protecting human life, it's ironic that you would shoot that when he shot that little girl in the back. What was ironic is that the person that she was fighting with could have very well been hit by that same bullet. So it seems to me that the protection of life wasn't a concern for him. What was probably a more pressing motivation was simply to shoot. And so the potential for killing that other girl who was there at the scene, who was the unintended target, the mere fact that she could have been killed because of his actions, doesn't resonate whatsoever in terms of, you know, a lot of law enforcement. So clearly, brother, you know, it's a very dangerous situation, and I think one of the things is not going anywhere. In fact, one of the things, if you think about all the attention cops are getting in terms of killing people, particularly African people, when you think about that, you think as a law enforcement, they would say, you know what, I need to be very circumspect in terms of, you know, whipping out this gun and shooting people because I'm under the gun, under the microscope. Well, it seems that despite this attention given to cops in terms of the propensity of killing African people, there's more killing. And after they convicted that the cop in Minnesota, Chauvin, after they convicted that guy, actually the amount of police shooting actually escalated. So how do you explain that? So clearly, aside from this kind of frustration that cops feel, this whole mindset in terms of, you know, the value of human life, particularly when it comes to African people, is not very, very important at all. So clearly, this is something that we have to address, something we've got to be concerned about. But I don't think picketing in and of itself, you know, in and of itself is going to resolve the situation. It's going to take a lot more in terms of the movement, in terms of bringing about a redress of this fundamental problem. Because we keep in mind, the problem that we're talking about is systematic. And no matter how much we want to believe that, in fact, these are just rogue cops, the bottom line, this is sanctioned by a system. So when we talk about the federal government's reluctance to get involved in terms of these kinds of killings, it speaks volumes in terms of their lack of compassion, lack of concern as these kind of tragedies continue to visit the African community. So clearly, you know, this is a systemic problem, and so as such, we have to understand that, you know, the marching is fine, but we have to think much deeper in terms of the kind of things we have to do in terms of bringing about redress when it comes to police killing unarmed black African people.
All right, that's going to one of our members and contributors. We're going to go to Susie. she critiqued and took a look at this article and reenacted more with her thoughts. As the article titled, Cop Trainer Lectures on How Great Sex Is After You Kill Somebody, calls it Perks of the Job. Susie, your take on this article, what did you get from it? What is concerning to you?
My main concern, if you have someone like this, Dave Grossman, going around to these police precincts and talking to the police, the thing of it is, who really is Dave Grossman? Is he part of the KKK? Is he part of the Aryan Nation? Apparently, he's part of something, and they are using him to spread, and it's like hypnotize these police officers to make a decision of who you want to be. And if the thing of it is, whoever assigns this particular individual or anyone like him to come and talk during the training needs to be stopped. And the thing about it, maybe somehow the community can maybe somehow take a look into these trainings, because first of all, like the Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, announced that they were banning him from participating in any, their police participating in any fear-based warrior-style training. So I think apparently this is something that they have individuals going around, and maybe if we can begin to finally really change the trend of thought that these police have, maybe, I'm not saying this killing will stop, but maybe it won't be as random as it is.
Okay, well, thank you, Susan, for your comment. We'll go to Alex. But before we go to Alex, all the guys just raised, when you look at the article and give this guy, David Grossman, legitimacy as the Army Ranger, a former psychology professor at West Point, plus he helped popularize the science of killology. What is killology? First time I have a brain cross that. What is the study of killing? Knowing how to kill, how to put people in a mindset to kill. So, Brother Alex, what you make of this phenomenon? The mic is yours, Brother Alex.
Well, Mr. Lee, when you first told me about reviewing the article, I couldn't believe it, so I went ahead and I thought I'd do more research on it. And I did that because I have family members who serve in law enforcement, like I'm sure a lot of us. But these are good cops. These are officers who have been jailers. These are officers who walk the street. These are officers who came out late at night to comfort a family who's had a gruesome loss at the hands of a perpetrator. These are good officers, and there are many of them out there. But it's the training that they receive. And we have to look at, there are officers out there that are mental to begin with. They shouldn't even be officers, should never even apply. And when they did apply, they should have been denied because they were not the material to protect someone. We have to look at the word itself, not just police officers, but peace officers, to serve and protect. They have to stand for the badge. But there are many officers don't stand for the badge. And for any officer to say that having sex or equivalent sex as something that they desire after killing someone is just crazy. Regardless of a warrior's mentality, it's always been the reasonable thought of any reasonable person that we look at life and we enjoy it. And out of life comes love. And that you take a person and you give them gifts and you care for them and you nurture them and you get into a relationship and maybe finally you may marry them and have children or whatever by them. That is the good part of love and sex. When a man looks at sex or is taught that to do something violent, to do something savage, to do something atrociously can't be the way of our military, can't be the way of our police force, can't be the way of our mentors and athletes, that we assault people without care, without compassion, to bring them around, to make them compliant until they lay there motionless. But that's what the police are being taught. And they're being taught by gentlemen such as this, who have that savage mentality, that until you have a man prone, prostrate to the ground, with a knee on his back, foot on his back, in handcuffs, shot two or three times, sprayed, tased, then he's compliant. You're not showing any love for that individual, period. Not at all. Not when others can walk free out the mass killing and come right out of the store and they barely got their hands on it. Come out of a school, shot up plenty of them, plenty of people, and they barely got their hands on them as they walk beside them. There's no rough pushing down of the head into the squad car or anything. They wait their time until the guy just normally gets a chance to get inside that squad car and pull off. But if a person of color was even holding a nail file, a water gun, a BB rifle, a bow and arrow, not even pointing it at the officer, maybe even trying to throw it behind a fence, when his hands go up in the air, his bullets fly. That's what we have to look at, how our police officers are being trained. Because most of these shooting ranges we go in, we see a black target. A black target. And these police officers are told to shoot center mass. They don't have arms, don't have legs. Center mass. If you shoot there, you might miss. You shoot into the white area, that's no good. Don't get any points. Won't get certified. Won't be a marksman here. But you shoot center mass until your clip is empty, until the threat is over. A black target surrounded by a white field. If you hit the white area, you did wrong. But as long as you concentrate your shell into that black center mass, then competent officer, and you deserve a marksman's badge. As long as the training and the perception that black is bad, white is good, we have a problem. We have a deep-rooted problem in this nation, and it goes into every walk of life that there is. But again, we have good officers out there, very good officers. But it's those bad ones that can give you your last day. And that's all I have to say.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break with a message, music with a message. And when we come back, we're going to close out this section, what's going on in Nick of your words. We would like to have some discussion on the recent decision dealing with George Floyd and his implications to our community. And we'd like for you to continue to weigh in and listen. And we'll be right back. Don't you go nowhere, because this is MPH Radio.
Choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend?
and share with black folks not of kin. People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you had your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right?
That's right. If there was no day or night, which one would you prefer to be right? People are still trying to make that choice. Welcome back to MPH Radio. And our final closing thoughts on the theme tonight, what's going on in Nicoya Woods? We'd like to just weigh in on people's position and understanding of what just recently took place on the Lady Verdict as it relates to George Floyd assassination. We'll start out with Brother Haki, give his thoughts on this. Brother Haki, what lessons can we learn and what can we expect moving forward in terms of the impact of this decision from your perspective?
I'm not sure, brother. I'm not sure what lessons we can learn from that. Because I would like to believe, well, much as I like to believe, that people did it based upon the rules that were so evident in that trial. But the bottom line is, we can't discount the reality is that there were lots and lots of people who were ready to take to the streets in the event this guy was acquitted. So I think the bottom line is that that may have played some role in terms of the jury's decision to acquit him, which means that the underlying problems that are so familiar when it comes to policing in the society are not subject to change by any stretch of the imagination simply because he was acquitted. One of the things I think that, it's good that he at least, he does give people hope. You know, things could be different, but if you don't remove the underlying structures that empower police, particularly when you talk about qualified immunity for cops, if you don't get rid of that, then essentially what you're doing is you're window dressing. So you're essentially encouraging cops to do what they do, simply because they can know they can care, at infinite, and they know that there's going to not be any type of repercussions in terms of killing people. So the first order of business, if they're sincere about ending, the numbers of killings by police, is to get rid of that qualified immunity. So I think that one thing has to happen. But more importantly, I think one of the things that we have to really disclose is the fact that when you look at the media, particularly the right-wing media, in terms of its presentation of the case, they were really disappointed because they come from the perception that, cops are always right. And, of course, these people are not victims of police brutality or police killings, and so, therefore, they conveniently take a position, that the cops can do no wrong. Of course, those of us who are aware or been exposed or personally observed, cops, malfeasance, then we understand the potential in terms of abuse by cops in our communities. And so therefore we have a vested interest in making sure, you know, that the cops operate on a different standard, or one standard in which, you know, justice for all is prevailing theme. But one thing I want to say real quickly, though, you know, we got to be clear, you know, it really doesn't matter if a cop is a good cop. It really doesn't matter. The bottom line, you have to operate in the context of the system. Typically what happens if a good cop is in law enforcement and he or she tries to do the job, you know, fairly, oftentimes they're castigated because they're castigated simply because they're perceived as not being a team player. And so there's tremendous pressure to conform. And so these good cops who initially came into the cops with the idea they're going to do what's right find themselves confronted with this kind of pressure. When if they don't conform, one thing is clear. Not only will they have a very difficult task in terms of doing their job, but they eventually find themselves out the door simply because they don't conform. So we got to be very clear that we understand we had to talk about this being a system and understand that it has nothing to do with individuals. It has to do with a system. And when you talk about the federal government surviving these cops with hundreds of millions of dollars of very sophisticated weaponry, then we got to ask ourselves, and so what is the implication? Why would you provide cops that kind of weaponry, knowing full well that it's going to be used to kill an increasingly larger and larger number of people? So clearly this is all part of a system, and so we got to stop playing games and pretending like if we just allude to individuals, then it's all right. Because one of the things that conservative television did was they talked about the fact that this was an individual case. It's not individual. The statistics are very clear in terms of the assassination of African people. Over 200 people a year die at the hands of cops every year. Most of them are African or Latino. So clearly, you know, it's not an individual problem. It's a systemic problem. And Joe Biden, the president of the United States, he understands that. The question is, what is he willing to do in terms of systematically, a systematic approach in terms of ending police brutality? My guess is that he's not going to do anything in terms of systematically, you know, moving to reduce or to eliminate police brutality. My position is that because this is a capitalist society, and one of the things is very, very clear, as more and more people become unemployed, more and more people become uneducated, more and more people don't have access to shelter, more and more people don't have access to hope, then we understand that people tend to act out. So the cops, as a first-line defense, is to maintain law and order, particularly to protect the wealthy people's property. So, of course, you want cops who are more brutal, not less brutal. And so the federal government understands they have a vested interest in making sure that they protect those cops to make sure that in all their brutality is protected simply because it serves their interest in the final analysis. So we got to understand this is, in fact, a system, and don't think about it as individuals. Think about it as a system. If we do anything to impact that system, then the bottom line is you're going to have more Derek Chauvin's, you know, which indicated in Chicago and in numerous places, Columbus, here recently, you know, in America. So clearly, you know, it's a systemic problem, and if we're sincere about resolving it, I want to see some systemic action in terms of, if not eliminating, at least greatly reducing police violence.
All right, Brother Aki, thank you for your contribution to today's program. We now will move to Susie. Just get your thoughts on the recent decision by George Floyd as based to the police assassination of him, and what we think may learn from this recent decision. Your final thoughts on this decision, Susie.
Okay, it was good that we got the turnout that we were looking for, but the only thing now that we have to look forward to is it really going to be truly justice? Because in August, I believe it's in August when they actually state how much time he'll get. Now, whether or not he'll get the full capacity of that time, because he had three offenses and you're not sure which one they're going to really stay. And the lowest amount of time he can get, I believe, is between, is it 5 and 10, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, the thing was, I was listening to an article by Occupy Democrats, reading the article they had, where they had a judge, Judge Deneen, which said that he was glad the guy was found guilty because there had been less violence occurring as a result if he wasn't found guilty. But in other words, he's still not guilty. Now, if you have a judge say that, that's that's defeating the whole purpose of what justice is supposed to be. He think he just got that time just so he could end up, they could end up not having a lot of damage to people, businesses, and things like that. And it's just something to think about. It's going to be interesting to see actually how much time he does get in August.
Thank you, Susie. You said the confusion continues. Yes, the judge is part of this process. And of course, he will have to protect his interests. And this is one thing, what, you know, opposition and enemy does is try to take your victory and make it look like it was a defeat. Yeah, I also have heard that language in terms of the victory wasn't really based upon justice and truth. They want you challenge your own eyes and what you saw. You can look at the truth, then they're going to tell you you didn't see it. But, you know, like we said, don't believe the hype, must not fall for it. Next, we go to Brother Alex. Before we go to Brother Alex, I would like to just say one of the things about that judge also that you raised, Sister Susie, about the whole question of judges. This particular judge, I thought was interesting, where he sort of was coaching on the bench to the defense, where he alluded to defense that he may have grounds for appeal to throw the courts, to throw the case out, because outside activities and what may have been said, i.e. people like Maxine Warner. But just by the point that he mentioned that we're doing coach on the bench shows a sense of a bias to me. And since the cases, even though they say he was guilty of three different issues, I understand it that when you do something concurrently, all together concurrently, the essence, what you may be looking at, you only will have to make him require you to be guilty of just one of the three charges, which means that right now, in terms of this question of how much time he may receive from those who are aware of the law and how they practice and implement the law, many people have stated that if he get any time, it's not going to be no more than 10 to a year at most, because he's going to try him on a lesser crime. As a result of tying all the three of these charges together concurrently, and there's a law in Minnesota that, regardless of the time that you are given, you only need to serve 2/3 of the time to be available to be released. So he may serve as little as 6 to 8 years at most, if that much. That's if he don't win the appeal. Not quite sure. I believe that'll be an appeal. So those are my takes, and we'll actually hear Alex. We'll bring Alex in and get his takes and his final thoughts on his verdict. Alex, the mic is yours.
Well, Susie, Ms. Lee, and our speaker, past speaker, I would agree on almost everything that you guys have said. And that's what we have to look at, how the sentencing will come down. They say a W is a W any kind of way you can get it when you're with the winning team, even if you cheated to win. I've heard that so many times. Also, I heard in court police officers saying that they don't have to pay fair. They don't always have to be right in what they do, because there were laws on the books that supported them. There were judges that supported them. And they had millions of Americans that supported them. But not only Americans. They've had support ever since the 1400s, when they first started taking the slaves out of Africa and delivered them into South America. Because there was no court in the world that had held these ship captains, these companies, these plantation owners, these gentlemen accountable for taking men in chains, women and children, another country, and enslaving them. There were no laws for these people. These people are color. There were no laws as they were taken all over the world. No court, no lawyer, no jury was looking and saying that this was wrong. So as we look at the policing of America, yes, it came from the slave patrol. And the idea was even enforced even more because it was late at night when those slaves ran. It was to get them, and bring them back. And if you couldn't, to kill them where they were, or to bring them back and lynch them so the others won't run. So that idea of keeping the man down, keeping him humble, keeping him compliant, has been passed down for generations as far as the people of color who came here in shackles and chains. Those are same handcuffs that we see as they walk people out. Because, see, I got you in custody. I got you in bondage. You're mine. And it's up to the court to decide whether you're free or not. America was on trial. The world was on trial. And it was brought to trial because of George Floyd. It was brought to trial because of so many other blacks who've died at the hands of the police force. So this was a win for maybe our side. But where do we move on from here? We need to get out and vote. We need to change things. We need to hear our voice being spoken. We need the laws to change, to back us and not the police. We need safe neighborhoods. We need safety on the job. We need safety in the school. There's a better way to do it than the present way we're doing it. It's not safe every time you call the police. We don't know what kind of person we're going to get. It's not the system that sends a police officer to your door. It's a cop who's thinking in his own right whether he has the power or not to change the situation. The situation can be good on a traffic stop for a ticket for you 5 miles over the speed limit or lost tag, missing registration, or just a from off your mirror where you can just give the person a ticket, a warning, and say, okay, have a great day. But when people walk up to you with guns drawn, F-bombs going left and right, threatening you, that they are going to end your life, pepper spraying you, tasing you, shooting you. What kind of mentality of policing is that? It all goes back to training. How you perceive another person. Because the police department didn't go out with you that day. You went out by yourself. You might have conspirators with you, but they are only going so far. One man killed George Floyd. One man usually kill a lot of folks, or one woman kill a lot of police as far as cops are concerned. But it's the others that stand around and do nothing about it, lie on police reports, back those cops up. And it's not a system of backing them up. But they have their job on the line, their families on the line, because they don't want to be involved. But we have to be involved, and we have to say what's right and what's wrong when we stand by it and see it being done. So that's where you have to get back to. If you see right and you know it's right, those jurors had no other choice. They saw right. They knew right. They felt right. And in their heart, they knew they were right. And I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex, for your contribution to today's program. So listen, audience, we're going to do something a little special. We have been able to connect with one of the other participants who have been able to connect with us now. and we definitely want to talk about what's going on in Nicolet Woods as it relates to what's going on in Philadelphia with Mumi Abu-Jamal. And what we can do right now is offer them the opportunity. Sister Emma Chi, who is the Govina founder of the Men and Women March and Movement, who've been working very closely with this case, and this case is very important, not only to the communities here, but throughout the world. We're going to bring her in, just let her give us an update on what's happening with the well-being status of Emil. So right now, Sister Empress, we welcome you to MPH Radio. The mic is yours.
Greetings, family. So I'm right here, right now, at the rally for Mumia. There's a couple of hundred people right here presently, and it's growing, it's building. Right now on the mic is Sister Pam Africa, and she just gave a brief overview report of what's happening with Mumia. The surgery was successful, as far as you can kind of say that heart surgery is successful. But you always have to wait, several days to really determine, and even sometimes weeks to really determine. And so I want you to just hear this briefly.
On Facebook, but that press conference again
shows clearly the kind of, not just injustices, but the kind of horrific behavior that the system, that this government implements, meaning they have had the bodies, or shall I say the remains, of Mu members, families, since 1985. They have now said that they was using that as part of their anthropology course or some stuff. But again, we'll give you more details on that tonight at 10:30. Join us at www.blogtalkradio.com/InfoChi. Again, www.blogtalkradio.com/InfoChi, or you can call 319-527-6189. Again, 319-527-6189. Back to you, Brother Lee.
Okay, well, Sister Lee, thank you for giving us an update on the condition of Mumia. I think we heard you earlier. You saying the surgery was successful. And again, for them to find out more information, they can contact what number, Sister Empress?
Okay, if they want more information, they can also call or email us at nationalmwm@aol.com. Remember, we're now in the process of obtaining our first 1,000,000 signatures that will be taken to the United Nations in December. This is the 70th year that Paul Robeson took the petition to the United Nations in 1951 on December 17th, where we are about to not only reenact that, but also to move it further, as Brother Malcolm taught us. Right now, this will mark Brother Malcolm X being in Africa in 1964, right at this time. And that was to begin to take our fight, our issues, to the heads of nations, to the United Nations, and ultimately address the African Union in regards to our human rights. And so again, we're picking up the mantle of our ancestors and saying, as he taught us, we must now go from civil rights to human rights. So again, we will assemble at the United Nations later this year, first to give the Declaration of Self-Determination. That'll be a mass rally at the United Nations. We'll give you the date on Malcolm X's Earth Day. And then in December, that'll be a 400-plus delegation of various groups, organizations, concerned folk, activists, humanitarians, etc., where we will present to the United Nations what we call the letter of intent. And it will begin the formal processing of charging this government with genocide.
Thank you, Sister Empress, for giving us an update, a live report of what's going on up in Philly as it relates around the health and well-being of Brother Mumia. And we'd like to thank everyone who was a participant and who allowed us to come to home this evening to share this particular program. Today's theme was, what's going on in the neck of your woods? We hope that we have brought you a message as such, and we'd like to remind you that you can listen to this radio program every other week, and our next program will be on the 8th of May, so please tune in at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, U.S., and if you have any questions, issues, and like to become a friend and support us, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. Until next time, we'd like to remind you, let's always strive to go forward wherever, and remind you that let's continue and fill in our missing pages of history, and we are here for you.
something we never had. Let's start with a good dad. So real, but it's so sad. And while we burning this incense, we gon' pray for the innocent. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about Chi-Town. Let's talk about Gaza. Let's talk about Israel. Right now with Israel. Let's talk Nigeria. In the mass hysteria. Yeah, our souls were brought together so that we could love each other, brother. Save the nation with no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it